week of July 26, 2009, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 13, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And also in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And in New York City, I'm Michael Giltz.
Besides Michael Giltz, joining us today is a plethora of people who spent their weekend in San Diego. And I'm just going to announce them alphabetically because that's really the only way I would know how to begin approaching this list. Beth Accomando is with us. She edits the Cinema Junkie blog for KPBS, where she began working in 1987. She is currently the president of the San Diego Film Critics Society and covered Comic-Con for NPR. She was also, interestingly enough, a judge for the Comic-Con International Film Festival, where 150 films screened in competition. She has also received 11 Southwestern Area Emmy Awards for producing, writing, and sound design. Welcome, Beth.
Thank you.
We also have Todd Gilchrist with us, and I've known Todd for years because we worked together back when I was with filmstew.com, and you were one of our lead journalists there. You moved on to IGN, and now you're a contributor for Cinematical and Sci-Fi Wire.
Correct.
And your Twitter account can be found at MT Gilchrist.
That's correct. If I ever Twitter, you can follow me there.
Good point. Yeah, that's right. I did check, and you have like two posts. Patrick Lee is the news editor for Sci-Fi Wire, the daily news and entertainment site for science fiction, fantasy, and the supernatural. They are part of the Sci-Fi family of websites, and actually that's spelled S-Y-F-Y, as we talked about a couple of weeks ago. He's been with Sci-Fi Wire for 10 years, and before that was a reporter for daily newspapers such as the Los Angeles Times and the Milwaukee Journal. You can find Patrick on Twitter. His handle is Ripley Cal, R-I-P-L-E-Y-C-A-L. Hi, Patrick.
Hi. Glad to be here.
Also joining us today is Harry Medved from Fandango. He's their spokesperson. And of course, Fandango is the nation's leading movie ticket destination. They have 8 million unique visitors per month visiting that website. I had no idea it was that many people. But certainly, they sold 15% of the domestic opening weekend box office for Twilight and 13% for The Dark Knight. Fandango was in San Diego covering Comic-Con. We will place a link to their coverage in our show notes. If you want to follow Harry on Twitter, you can do so. Fandango News is the link. Philip Knockoff is also with us. He's from Movieset.com. He's the vice president of marketing and publicity there, and he runs his own marketing and PR consultancy, City PR. But Philip has been an entrepreneur for more than 12 years, and I've known him, I think, most of those 12 years. When you started, you were on the startup team at the Hollywood Stock Exchange, and you left there in 2000, I believe, to start CountingDown.com, where you were the editor-in-chief. Of course, Counting Down was one of the first social networks centered around film. And you have such a reputation, Philip, that you were tapped by how do you pronounce it? Is it Reels Channel or Reels Z Channel?
No, it's the Reels Channel.
Okay, yeah. You recently put together their accompanying website, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
And you are on Twitter. Voyager1 is your account.
That would be me.
So not all at once, but what did you guys think of Comic-Con? Beth?
Well, I had a great time. Working on the judging panel for the film festival was really amazing. The thing that surprised me the most was the high quality of documentaries. I was expecting to see a lot of good science fiction and a lot of good animation, but there were some amazing documentaries on as diverse a subject as the punk rock posters in Seattle in the 70s to a film about these Italian photo novels that came out in the 60s and 70s that sold like in the hundreds of thousands every 2 weeks. So it was a really exciting festival to be a part of. And the film 9 this year that had a panel in the Hall H was a film that had shown a number of years ago as a short at the International Film Festival.
Now, what about you, Todd? I know you're a long time science fiction fan working for IGN.
I spent all day Thursday and Friday in Hall H, and the better part of Saturday. And I thought pretty much everything looked terrific that I saw. The difference between this year, I think, and past years was that there wasn't quite, with maybe the exception of Avatar, I didn't feel like there was quite the sense of discovery that we've enjoyed in past years. For example, as good as the footage from Iron Man looked on Saturday afternoon, I felt like there was a familiarity with characters, even though they did premiere some images of of Mickey Rourke's character and Scarlett Johansson and War Machine, that I felt like was pretty exciting, but at the same time, it wasn't anything where everybody, I think, although they were excited, they weren't blown away by the sort of newness of what they saw.
Were any of you blown away by anything you saw? Now, of course, most of you cover film rather than television, and Comic-Con does have a television section. But were any of you blown away by say, Avatar, which is James Cameron's next film, which screened there?
Actually, what surprised me was Kick-Ass, the panel for that, which was...
Absolutely.
That looked like a total blast, just fun, and very inspired, and just... It had the same flavor as Shoot 'Em Up, but Shoot 'Em Up had a panel there that totally thrilled the crowd at Hall H, but it failed to really deliver at the box office, so I don't know if the same fate may await Kick-Ass, but it was fun, it was wild, it had the kind of action that you used to see in old Hong Kong action films, and just kind of a real joy.
I agree with that, with Kick-Ass, I definitely thought so, and I thought that a lot of people were a little bit underwhelmed by Avatar, but I really did feel like what worked about it and what did make it amazing was its combination of sort of technical virtuosity and sort of storytelling, which we certainly have seen in different capacities, but not yet quite in such a virtuoso way in 3D. And I just thought that its technology and its storytelling and literally its artistry was just was really amazing. I was really blown away.
And so, wait, you said people were underwhelmed by Avatar?
A little bit. There were people who heard Cameron's repeated pitches thus far saying that this was going to be the future of cinema and this was going to be the next big thing. There's never going to be anything like it that you've seen before. And I feel like people came away going, well, actually, I don't feel like this is necessarily like a true revolution. It may be just an evolution. And so, you know, I don't mean that to suggest that people were not blown away, but I think that they were not transformed in the way that maybe some people expected to be.
Well, Michael Seepley of the New York Times in his piece said that James Cameron's Avatar had Comic-Con fans roaring with approval, and he also said Mr. Cameron's devotion to next-generation 3D methods has raised enormous expectations around a film made with technology that some people predict could have an impact on movies comparable to the introduction of sound, much as you were saying. And I should mention that Brooks Barnes also contributed to that piece in the New York Times.
Yeah, I think that was a little bit of hype, huh? This is Harry, but I don't think that, you know, this is not like the coming of sound pictures for Hollywood. And also Tom Rothman, the head of Fox, who introduced it, compared James Cameron to David Lean, which, you know, the great filmmaker, and I think only in terms that he goes over budget and his movies last like 3 hours long.
Well, that's a bold statement, I agree. I mean, that's a pretty big statement. David Lean, of course, Lawrence of Arabia, Bridge on the River Kwai. Why can't I pronounce that?
But I do disagree with you. I think that I think the fans were roaring for Avatar, and I think it wasn't just the technology. I think it was the original content, and I think that's one of the themes this year of Comic-Con that we see in Fandango, at least, is that you know, as Josh Brolin said during the Jonah Hex panel, audiences are a lot smarter than the studios give them credit for, and so you saw a lot of original content on display this year. The discovery for me was District 9, which had its first public showing on Thursday night. And I think people expect it to be good. I didn't expect it to be that good. I mean, it was just mind-blowingly good and definitely one of the best films of the year so far, along with Pixar's Up and 500 Days of Summer.
This is Patrick. I would agree with that. I was blown away by the Avatar footage in Hall H, and I agree that the crowd loved it until I saw District 9. And I think it is so unexpected and so innovative in terms of its story and the way it integrates sophisticated visual effects with a really gritty, almost verite style, that it makes Avatar look a little old-fashioned. And in retrospect, I think that was the big surprise for me out of Comic-Con this year.
Philip, do you know about District 9?
Yes.
So what is District 9?
You know, so much of District 9 isn't really clear what it is. They're being very, very smart the way they're marketing that movie. They're making it seem as if it's a, you know, almost a documentary-like in terms of the way it's being presented with the realistic type footage. And then with all of the panels and all of the billboards and the warning, this street is only for humans and this bus bench is only for humans. I mean, they're really taking it to a whole, you know, they're blurring the lines between reality and fantasy, which I think is what is so appealing to the people at Comic-Con. And then ultimately what I think will turn audiences on to this concept, because it's more than just a movie. It's a concept.
Well, also the interesting thing about District 9 is District 9 and the other film, 9, which makes this very confusing, are both films by first-time filmmakers produced by filmmakers themselves who have very, you know, high-profile personalities. You have Tim Burton producing 9, and you have Peter Jackson of Lord of the Rings fame producing District 9. And I think it's really interesting that these filmmakers are taking these young filmmakers under their wing, helping them get their films out there. And in the case of District 9, I think what appeals to Comic-Con fans is not just that it's a science fiction film, that it's got some great-looking action and great-looking effects, but it returns the science fiction to kind of these stories where the characters and the impact of what kind of the fantasy elements are on the human characters is placed in the forefront. And I think a lot of the Comic-Con fans, the ones who've been there for a long time, are fans who are real fans of like science fiction literature and comic books, and they do have, you know, they have an appreciation of effects and, you know, kick-ass action, but they also want to see good stories. And District 9 really looks like it's playing with issues of racism and the setting in South Africa and dealing with issues between aliens and humans that reflects, you know, problems that are going on in contemporary South Africa are really interesting for fans, too.
When does District 9 actually get released?
That, I believe, is coming out later this summer. Or is that the one that's coming out in January? I can't remember. So many of these films are...
I think it comes out August 14th or 16th.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. August 14th sounds familiar. There's one film that they previewed that wasn't coming out till January, and I was thinking, like, wow, I'm going to have to wait that long to see it.
That was Legion, I believe.
Is it Legion? Okay.
I think so, yeah.
Well, the thing also I think that really strikes a chord with so many of the fans in regards to District 9 is that just much like Bryan Singer's X-Men, it deals with the whole part of discrimination and a part of our society that's misunderstood. And let's face it, society as a whole, and certainly, you know, mass media does do the exact same thing to the attendees at Comic-Con. I mean, they are, for the better part, until very, very recently that they've been embraced by Hollywood. But, I mean, the fans at Comic-Con are made fun of, ridiculed, and called geeks and super geeks and mega geeks. And, you know, I think that that's why it really strikes a chord with them, because, you know, it talks to them. They are also the people that are, you know, misunderstood or marginalized.
Yeah, it's Patrick again. I think, speaking as a science fiction fan and covering science fiction, I think it's important to note, as much as it has these, District 9 has the subtext of the social commentary and some satirical elements that are important, the movie does not disappoint as a full-on science fiction action R-rated splatter movie either. It has very crowd-pleasing elements in it, which is one of the surprising things for me, having looked at the marketing. Because it is being marketed almost as an alienation kind of commentary on apartheid or something. And it has those elements, but it also has these other elements in it. And I think people are going to be surprised by that.
See, I think that's the joy of Comic-Con, is always discovering this new content. And as Cameron said to Fandango, I think he also told us to USA Today, when's the last time you went into a movie where you hadn't read the book, like Twilight, or it wasn't a sequel or a remake? But you just took a journey and you had no idea where the movie was going. And that's certainly the case with Avatar and the footage we saw and with District 9. That's the joy of discovering these films at Comic-Con.
Well, now, back in 1970 when Comic-Con first started, I guess it started in 1969 maybe, but it's 40 years old, and 300 people went to Comic-Con. And just to give you some sense as to the scale of this convention, and I don't think we have to explain what this convention is. It's a science fiction comic book film. I mean, it's a huge convention based around pop culture. And in 1992, there were 22,000 people attending Comic-Con in San Diego. And as I mentioned, to give you some size of the scale, Sundance has about 53,000 people attend it each year. Cannes has about, the film festival in Cannes has about 75,000 people attend each year. In 2004, 95,000 people attended Comic-Con, and this year a reported 126,000 people, which matches their tally from last year. 126,000 people attended the show, which just to give again some scale, 41,000 people attend E3, the video game convention. Macworld has 48,000 people attend it. 50,000 people attended the Democratic National Convention, and 45,000 people attended the Republican National Convention. I mean, that's 126,000 people. That is an enormous amount of people. How do you even move around?
Sometimes you don't.
You actually don't much.
But, you know, yeah, for that point, if I could just make a comment in it, I'm actually surprised that no one has actually talked more about this or discussed this. But, you know, to bring 126,000 people into one location, a very, very compacted, tight location, who come from very different socioeconomic groups, literally all ages. I saw infants that were 4 months old to 87-year-old grandfathers wearing costumes. And you don't see the fights, you don't see the arrests, you don't see the type of hooliganism that one would expect when you bring that number of people from so many different areas together. I mean, if anything, someone should, you know, point to the fact this is a peaceful assembly of a tremendous amount of people in one place, and yet, you know, It's I think it's truly remarkable, and if anything, it's a true testament to the growth and to the sustainable nature of the arts in our society.
So what you're saying is Comic-Con has something to live up to. They can, you know, import some hooligans and start a few fights.
Well, yeah. I would also add to that. I mean, the convention is so much a celebration of fandom and the enthusiasm that these people all have for this material and. And quite frankly, how much enthusiasm they want to have for material. I mean, the only time I heard anybody boo anyone in the in Hall H in 3 days was when a moderator made fun of one fan's question in front of the entire audience. And, you know, and it was because I think because everybody wants to share and celebrate in the sort of admittedly idiotic but very passionate and sincere enthusiasm for all these things, no matter if it's Roland Emmerich or James Cameron or anything else. And I think that's probably the main reason that there are so few, sort of problems as you were describing of other things where they sort of bring everybody together.
Well, now, did any of you, you just mentioned Roland Emmerich, did any of you see the 2012 footage, which is Roland Emmerich's next film?
I did.
And was it any good?
Oh.
There were a lot, amongst my colleagues, there was a reaction that this looks so bad that it's good. I thought it looked so bad that it was kind of bad, but it is absolutely what it is, which is to say a complete and total over-the-top disaster movie. I mean, it's like Irwin Allen times 100.
Philip, did you see the 2012 footage?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not exactly probably the targeted demo for that movie, but just the amount of stuff that was being thrown up on the screen, you know, story or no story, but just the visual, you know, imagery that was on there was such eye candy. I didn't know where to look, and I didn't know what not to look at. It was truly overwhelming.
What was overwhelming? All weekend, I sat here in Los Angeles trying to keep up with all the Twitter posts and Facebook messages and all of the blog posts and newspaper articles about Comic-Con. I was exhausted, as I told Beth before the show started. I was exhausted just reading all this stuff, and I didn't even go.
I was sitting next to someone. I was at the Starship SmackDown panel, which if nobody's ever gone to is quite fun, where they, you know, they nominate a captain, they nominate a ship and a situation, and then they vote on who would actually survive the situation, who would be best in charge. But there was a person next to me Twittering, like, who the nominations were and how the voting was going and which direction stuff was. And, you know, it was hilarious.
Well, now, it seemed to me there were people waiting outside of Hall H. Now, Hall H, just so that listeners know, is a huge hall at the San Diego Convention Center where Comic-Con is held that holds 6,500 people, and it's where the Disney 3D demo was. It's where all of the big presentations are given. And it seemed to me that Twilight New Moon, the next iteration or the next episode in the Twilight series, received the biggest response, at least on Thursday, or maybe it was Friday. I can't remember.
Thursday. They camped out. They were the Twilight moms were camped out for about 30 hours out in front of Hall H. And I mean, the one thing I would say is it was too bad that Twilight wasn't the first panel of the day on Thursday, because a lot of people waited in line for Twilight and kind of pushed people out who wanted to see some of the panels before that. Because they were just so ravenous to see the Twilight panel. And you could barely hear a lot of the Twilight panel because people were screaming and yelling as soon every time Robert Pattinson opened his mouth, and you could barely hear anything.
Did you think that the New Moon panel was as fervent and as
I think they were crazier this year. I mean, it seemed louder, and I think more of them got in line. And I mean, last year I had interviewed people who were in line waiting, and I had to go about 40 or 50 people back to find somebody who wasn't in line for Twilight. This year I think it was like thousands of people or hundreds, at least hundreds, multiple hundreds of people in line just for Twilight. I couldn't find anyone.
Well, there were two signs of the influence of the Twilight fans this year. Before Comic-Con, when Fox learned that the Twilight panel was going to be happening after Avatar, they actually changed the timing of the panel so that Twilight occurred first and Avatar occurred later. Mm-hmm. The other example of how many people were there was there was a surprise appearance by Johnny Depp during the Disney panel, in which he just basically came out and said hello and waved to the crowd, and all of the Twilight fans screamed so loud it was deafening.
I think they scared him away.
Yes, it kind of did.
Yeah, and I think regarding Twilight, the one big news there was that when they first hired Chris Weitz to direct the film, because Catherine Hardwicke wanted to take more time on the second Twilight movie, there were so many fans online who were so upset. How could a man direct a woman's story like this? And I think this is the redemption of Chris Weitz, that he was very much accepted. In fact, I was shocked. I don't know if you guys were surprised at how much the cast was pretty much bashing Catherine Hardwicke, the director of the first film. They never mentioned her name, but they always said what Chris brings to the table as a director of New Moon, the second Twilight film, is a certain kind of calm, assurance, a confidence. He knows what he's doing. The implication there is that Catherine didn't know what she was doing, and I don't think that's the case.
To defend the movie a little bit, I would say the original Twilight, which is not a movie that I was especially a fan of, the impression I get from the production of that movie was that it was done so hastily and cheaply that as a consequence, you know, it was probably pretty breakneck in terms of getting it done. I mean, I think there was an inkling that it might become the phenomenon that it did, that it has become. And so I'm sure that that's entirely accurate, the way that they're describing the difference in the atmospheres of those two productions. But at the same time, I think Hardwicke captured the character details, and I think that she was maybe inexperienced in terms of special effects and action, which ultimately I think is where the first movie suffered the most. And I think by comparison, Chris Weitz has much more of a facility with that kind of material.
Agreed, but I do think that Catherine brought a certain feminine sensibility to the story, and I think people were worried that this one would not have that much appeal for the females, because it's all about werewolves, but that was put to rest when they had at least one scene of Taylor Lautner, who plays Jacob, suddenly ripping off his shirt to take care of a wound on Kristen Stewart, and you could just hear the theater of girls, just 7,000 of them going, "Aah!" You know, and he's taking off his shirt and showing off his stomach muscles.
It wasn't just girls. There were a lot of the Twilight moms.
And a few men. Women
and
there.
Yes, yeah. You wouldn't call them girls,
and,
I guess.
Patton Oswalt observed there were a lot of sensitive men there.
Yeah.
That's right. Patton Oswalt was screaming the most when Taylor Lautner took his shirt off, I think.
I love what James Rocky had to say about the New Moon panel. I mean, he said, first off, entry required. Now, James Rocky writes for MSN Movies. He said, entry required bringing a hard printout of your confirmation letter plus photo ID. And that was required to get into the press conference. He then goes on to say,
"First for Comic-Con, in my memory."
That's a first for Comic-Con, Patrick?
As far as I can recall, and I've been doing this for 8 years now, that the first time they've ever wanted a confirmation letter that you were in fact invited and a member of the media.
Wow!
So yeah, well, and it was off-site. It was at a hotel.
It's a fairly fierce level of security, and the fact I'm viewing it with such confusion brings to mind the way your grandparents looked askance when your mom and dad went insane for the Beatles. And Patton Oswalt, you mentioned Patton Oswalt. Apparently, he was quite funny. And he kind of mocked Hollywood's whole hysteria over camera phones and recording. He said, Patton Oswalt mocked Comic-Con's reputation as a source of leaks, encouraging the audience to break out their camera phones, because there's no better way to honor a filmmaker who's broken his back to make a movie than by leaking a shaky low-res footage version onto the net.
Well, you know, Hollywood is kind of so schizophrenic about this, because on the one hand, they bring this stuff there because they want buzz. They want people talking about their films, and they want people excited about them. And they come in, and they seem so paranoid about revealing anything that, you know, it's kind of they're being pulled in both directions. I mean, the danger for them is always if they show exclusive footage and the audience doesn't like it. But that's been fairly rare that I can remember. But, you know, people get excited about this stuff. And when they leak the footage, generally speaking, if it does get leaked, because there's actually less out there than you might think in terms of the actual footage. I mean, panel footage gets out, but not really the like trailers and exclusive footage. But
I don't think there's ever been a case where they've said we can't videotape the panel footage. That's fine. They just don't want what is actually being projected on the screens to go out.
Well, now you mentioned all these, you know, videotaping of the panels, and I should mention that Ann Thompson, she's got a bunch of videos from these panels, specifically one I'd like to call your attention to, which is called Comic-Con Visionaries Jackson and Cameron Talk Future. And she said it was the high point of the convention for her when Jeff Gillis interviewed Peter Jackson and James Cameron. The two men respect each other enormously. What his achievement with Lord of the Rings, Gollum convinced Cameron that he might be able to forge ahead with Avatar, which had been collecting dust for more than a decade. I could listen to these guys talk all day. I love it that they respect their audience, they make smart movies to please themselves and everyone else at the same time, which is really hard. Now, this was Peter Jackson's first trip, believe it or not, to Comic-Con.
Well, he's been there in videotaped appearances, but this is the first time he's actually physically come to the show. But I think, you know, there's a difference, I think, in some of those film panels. I mean, the Twilight panel, I feel like it's very much these fans who are just there to see celebrities and to see these people that they are passionate about. But you go to panels like the Terry Gilliam one for the Imagination of Dr. Parnassus, or the Visionaries panel, or Park Chan-wook was there to promote his South Korean film Thirst. And there's a different tone to those panels where people are really there to hear what these filmmakers have to say. And these are filmmakers who are kind of pushing the envelope on things and bucking the Hollywood system. People like Terry Gilliam said, you know, I like to deal with ideas that I don't want mucked with or messed with by someone else. And because of that, I don't have the big budgets that some other filmmakers get, but that's the price I'm willing to pay. And those kind of panels, I mean, I totally agree that those kind of panels are fascinating, because you're hearing these directors talk very openly and honestly about what it takes to put their vision up on the screen.
Now, Beth, you mentioned Terry Gilliam. It was, if I'm not mistaken, his first time at Comic-Con as well. It was Tim Burton's first time at Comic-Con as well, and he was bringing Alice. Actually, it wasn't his first time, but it was his first time as a presenter. And he brought Alice in Wonderland, which is going to be done in 3D, and the surprise, of course, was that Johnny Depp was there.
Who said nothing.
but the footage, the little bit of footage they had from Alice in Wonderland was haunting, I thought. I don't know what you guys thought.
Yeah,
just like the Tweedledee and Tweedledum, wow.
Yeah, it looked amazing.
That's what all the reports say, is that film looks amazing. And certainly, and this is what gets me. I mean, we just talked about the camera phones and the taping of videotaping of panels. But what gets me is that at Cinema Expo last month, when they first showed Avatar to European cinema owners, the security behind it was enormous. The journalists in the crowd were not allowed to write about the fact that they saw it. They could write about the reaction, but not anything about the footage. And when you went into the Disney Alice in Wonderland exhibit, which was this huge exhibit where you got to walk through all these rooms, you had to sign a non-disclosure agreement, and you couldn't take any of the material they gave you, which was a little book that explained the story and the costumes and everything. You couldn't take any of that along with you. And here, cinema owners have a vested interest in fighting piracy, and they're treating them like criminals. And then they go to San Diego and invite a whole bunch of screaming 16-year-olds into the room, and it's fine.
You know, I mean, I think that reflects what the what Comic-Con is all about. It's about fans, and you know, they're not. You can't search people coming in to Hall H and tell them they can't bring their cell phones or they can't bring their movie cameras or anything like that. You either have to, the studios either have to live with it, or they have to say, no, we're not going to show anything. And if you don't show anything, then you're going to get booed out of the hall. So it's kind of a fact of life at Comic-Con where you're going to have to either accept the way that a fan-based convention runs like that, or you just don't show up.
Now, about Comic-Con, Mark Grazer of Variety said that studios clearly had a list of talking points. And I wonder if you guys agree or disagree with this. 3D isn't just a gimmick anymore, but a primary reason to head to the Megaplex. That was one.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Okay.
This was the first year they refitted Hall H to allow them to screen things in 3D, and they had a massive screen up front to replace the 2D monitors that used to be there. So I think they made a major commitment there.
Yeah, and Mark Grazer actually at the front of Comic-Con had an article, which we'll link to in the show notes, which was talking about how 3D basically won that day, I guess it was Thursday, at the mm-hmm. convention. And there was some talk about whether 3D could actually be pulled off in Hall H, because 3D inherently has a lower light level, so of course the larger the image, the dimmer the picture. And they pulled it off in Cannes with Up. Apparently, according to Mark Grazer, they said that Comic-Con organizers outfitted Hall H with 4 silver screens to show the 3D footage and handed out thousands of pairs of Dolby 3D digital cinema glasses.
Yep.
And now...
That looked pretty great.
Just to give you some sense about what that kind of cost is, 6,500 people, those glasses cost at least $30 a pair. And so collecting them, I would imagine, was a big task, although... I think it was Michael Siepley in the New York Times who said that a couple of them were found broken on the floor that he saw.
Sperling, I don't believe that it actually cost $30 a pair for those glasses that they had at Comic-Con. Do you?
Well, I know that when in the past, when I've published on Celluloid Junkie, when I gave a quote of $25 per pair, I got, let's just say somebody from Dolby came to talk to me and they weren't too happy. They do charge exhibitors definitely more than $20 and as much as they used to charge them $50 and have lowered the price to $30.
Okay. Well, I guess that explains why it costs so much more to buy a ticket for a 3D movie.
That is exactly why. Not to mention, of course, the cost of the digital cinema equipment to run a 3D movie. Now, Todd, you had something you wanted to say about 3D as well.
Yeah, basically, the reason I think that the 3D seemed to work as well as it did this year was because most of the movies that they showed 3D footage for were not films that involved 3D that was not coming out of the frame as much, and I think that may be why they were more successful with it. I mean, not to get into a huge technical discussion about the nature of 3D, but they have, you know, there are sort of two schools of thought on 3D right now. One is that it comes out of the screen. The other one is that you're sort of looking through a window at a 3D world.
I think Tom's right, though. They're mostly movies looking through a window at a 3D world.
Right, like Coraline was.
Right.
Yes.
Not with, like, spears being chucked at the camera.
Exactly.
Well, now, another point that Mark Grazer said that studios wanted to make was the next installment of the Twilight franchise is in good hands with director Chris Weitz. Does everybody agree with that?
Yeah, there was no criticism of Chris Weitz's direction there. The girls seemed very happy, and the moms.
But the truth of the matter is, I think that the Twilight fans are so really driven by the stars and the celebrity of Twilight mm-hmm. that if they were to say that this movie was being directed by... you know, by a computer, they'd be like, "Oh, great, great! Show us more of Robert Pattinson." It's. I don't think that the concept that there was a change in the director really makes that much of an impact, because I don't think, and I'll probably get emails for this, but I don't think that many people in the audience really know how much movie changes from director to director.
Yeah, I think you're right. If they had recast Jacob with another actress, that's Taylor Lautner, that would have been a bigger problem.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, I think they look to the films more as like this visual dictionary. I mean, I think they are enamored with the books. I don't think they feel that the films are necessarily capturing everything the books had, but they're very happy with the actors who are playing them and who are visually representing them. And so it's kind of like, hey, it's the visual dictionary where we can see what everything looks like, but they're not that invested in how well told or how well made I think the individual films are, just that it kind of keeps those actors in place for them.
And Twilight has really become, for many of the people that I spoke to in line, you know, the people that were at the head of the line there, they had arrived at 9 p.m. on Tuesday night for the panel that was on Thursday. They were sleeping there in a tent. They were, you know, talking about it. They were very, very excited. And it really has become a cultural phenomenon for children, you know, girls, mothers, and grandmothers to share collectively. And it's really about the time that they're able to spend together and sharing an interest in common, which is so very rare these days, where, you know, society is, you know, the parents are doing one thing and the kids are doing another thing in the other room. This is bringing them together, which is, you know, so lost in our culture of instant gratification with media.
Well, now, Mark Razor also believes that the studio's talking points related to New Line's reboot of A Nightmare on Elm Street with Jackie Earle Haley as Freddy Krueger, which he said is far scarier than previous installments in the franchise. Do you guys agree?
I don't agree. Having actually been to the set of the movie, you know, I don't think that it looks scarier. I think that it's going to be slicker and more professional. I actually like the guys at Platinum Dunes who do these remakes. I mean, they did the Friday the 13th remake, and I thought that was terrific. But one of my colleagues who writes for a horror site, you know, made the observation, and I think it's correct, that this movie looks exactly like what you would want a remake of Nightmare on Elm Street to be, albeit updated for a modern audience. And I mean, which is not necessarily a bad thing. I just don't think that it's anything going to substantively more scary or intense than previous one necessarily. But then again, we only saw like a 3-minute clip.
Does everybody else agree with that?
Well, I think that having Jackie Earle Haley as Freddy definitely brings something to the movie, because of all the, you know, the kind of the background of Jackie Earle Haley as an actor, from playing the child molester in Little Children to Rorschach to, you know, all the other roles. Like, going back to like Day of the Locust, remember he was a little kid who gets stomped on by Donald Sutherland in that movie? So, you know, he's got this history of being a child abuser or being abused as a child. And it kind of works to have him suddenly playing Freddy in the movie.
I agree with that.
I think it's easy to forget that the original Nightmare on Street was not as jokey as the sequel, and it was, for its time, a scary movie. I think in remaking that kind of movie for a modern audience, you necessarily have to amp it up a little bit because people are kind of jaded with this sort of thing. But
well, now, Mark Razor also has two other points, that Where the Wild Things Are has the approval of author Maurice Sendak, and as you guys talked about earlier, Sony's District 9 is a thinking person's alien movie, which I think from what you've said earlier, you all agree with.
Yeah, Wild Things was certainly a huge improvement over what people were saying about Wild Things a few years ago. You remember there was a lot of bad buzz in that film, and I think they had to reshoot a whole bunch of it and recast the lead child actor. And I will tell you that I talked to a lot of people, I think Todd, you were there too, who were trying to hold back their tears. It was in a very emotional collection of clips that they had that really recreated the scenes of childhood and a child's imagination like no other film, and showing that Spike Jonze was the perfect director for this movie.
Yeah, the fact that they managed to work, I think, a lens flare into every shot of amazing CGI but that made it look completely natural and authentic, as opposed to like looking like the sort of artifice of something like Star Trek, which also had lens flares in every shot, gave it such a sort of human, sort of nostalgic childhood feeling that as you're watching it, you're just like, this is the saddest, most awesome thing I've ever seen.
Yeah. When I first saw those costumes, I was worried it was going to look like a big screen version of H.R. Puff and stuff, or, you know, one of those really bad Sid and Marty Krofft movies or something.
Did anybody see
Banana Splits, maybe.
Did anybody see the Iron Man 2 footage?
Yeah, I did. Again, I think, like I said a little bit earlier, I feel like the sense of discovery that people had 2 years ago when they premiered footage of it was not there. But I think everything that they showed looked really promising and really good. And you get sense that they are truly that Jon Favreau has that franchise well in hand, not only for this film, but he mentioned that, you know, Avengers is coming, and it's not shooting until after this one is done. So he sort of hinted at the fact that he would sort of be shepherding.
Well, yeah, and actually in the Variety story, they mentioned that not only is the film Iron Man 2 opening in May of 2010, but that Don Cheadle is replacing Terrence Stamp. What's that all about?
Terrence Howard.
Sorry. Yes, you're right. Terrence Howard.
I think it was a money issue on that. I think it wasn't. Does anybody know? Yeah. I thought he had wanted more money for the part to come back.
My understanding was that Terrence Howard was one of the first guys they cast in the first Iron Man movie, and they offered him a bit more money than I think they had to adjust everybody's salaries for the sequel, and his would have been adjusted far more than the others, I think. That's the spell that I heard.
Hopefully Terrence Howard has a new agent now.
Good point. You know, as Todd, you were just saying that the Avengers film is going to shoot after Iron Man 2, there are characters being inserted into Iron Man 2 that will kind of follow through to the Avengers film.
Yeah, well, Nick Fury, played by Samuel Jackson, is definitely in it. They didn't mention whether any other characters would be in there, but Favreau did say that he was seeing footage from Thor, which he felt like was sort of, you know, everything was sort of dovetailing into what eventually would become the Avengers movie.
Well, and Robert Downey Jr. was there to support the film, which was a big surprise, and I'm sure people...
Well, he was there for two panels. He was also there for the Sherlock Holmes film.
That's right.
Which what did you guys think of the Sherlock Holmes footage? I think, Todd, were you the one who said it looked a little bit like Wild Wild West?
I didn't.
The TV show or the movie? There's a big difference.
The movie, scarily enough, and they're both from Warner Brothers.
Well, I'll jump in regards to the Iron Man 2 panel. I was sort of let down that they didn't show, you know, if they don't actually have completed footage, they should, and it worked so well where they actually show footage that was just shot on set and, you know, a how-to or behind-the-scenes making of a particular portion of the movie. And that would have, I think, gone much further in terms of upping the wow factor. Whereas they showed us a ridiculously long, albeit comedic, sequence where he was testifying in front of a Senate panel. I didn't feel we learned anything, and it was just whatever. It was him doing comedy with Gary Shandling.
Now, did any of you get to make it out to the exhibit floor? Because part of Comic-Con is the exhibition hall where people can go and buy comic books and action figures and costumes and you name it, you can buy it in that exhibit hall. Did any of you make it out onto that floor?
Oh, yeah. It's hard to get back and forth. It's about a quarter mile long, but you know, I collect Godzilla toys, so I was cruising back and forth looking for those, and I got my Resident Evil t-shirt, which I love, which I don't know if anybody saw it, but it says, let your dark side out, and you pull it over your head, and underneath the shirt is a zombie face that you can then put on your face. Definitely the best t-shirt out there.
Well, James Rocky, writing for MSN, said that, this is one of my favorite quotes from his writing about Comic-Con this year. He wrote, "This is why I've always scoffed at the insistence of film journalist friends who insist that Comic-Con is just like, say, Sundance or Cannes. I've never seen someone at Cannes dress up like Lars von Trier or Agnes Varda." Outside, of course, Lars von Trier and Agnes Varda. And, of course, he's referencing the fact that in that exhibit hall there's tons of people dressed up in costumes.
I'll tell you what was missing from the exhibit hall this year is that you didn't have anything like the Owl Ship from Watchmen last year where everybody was oohing and aahing. It was mostly the same old stuff. The
James
Camaro and Bumblebee from Transformers.
James Cameron had brought the Mecha thing from Avatar. A couple of the studios took effort to have stuff outside of Comic-Con. Disney had set up Flynn's Arcade, the first Tron movie.
Well, I know Philip has to take off. Todd, I know you have to take off. Disney, as you were mentioning, they had a big day there. They screened Robert Zemeckis' next film, which opens this Christmas, A Christmas Carol. What did people think of that?
I think people were a little underwhelmed. I didn't sense that there was a huge swell of appreciation for it. I don't know if anybody else had the same impression.
It wasn't a very good clip that they showed either. It was kind of long and didn't deliver on much. But I mean, I think what was more interesting about the Disney panel was they brought out for the very first time Hayao Miyazaki, the great Japanese animation director who has a new film, Ponyo on a Cliff by a Sea. He directed Princess Mononoke and Spirited Away. I mean, he doesn't make that many public appearances, and to have him come out here at Comic-Con was amazing.
And Ponyo is supposed to be fantastic.
Yeah, Beth, did you see it?
Yes.
You went and you saw the
movie?
Yes.
No, I haven't seen the movie yet. I've seen clips from, but I haven't seen the whole film yet.
Yeah, because the clips look so amazing, huh?
Yes. I mean, it looks... And his work is amazing. I mean, it's beautiful stuff. I mean, it's interesting that while Hollywood's really pushing technology, and here's the state-of-the-art 3D, and here's the best stuff that we can do, you know, some of the Japanese anime is still... I mean, I think they're still incorporating hand-drawn elements into his films, and... But what they have is they have this exquisite storytelling and an amazing sense of artistry, and also films like they had the DVD release for Coraline and also the film Nine, and these are films that are using more kind of handmade effects. I mean, there's stop motion animation in Coraline, and same thing. Nine has this very kind of DIY quality to it. And so I think there are a group of filmmakers that while technology is helping them to create films more easily, they're also holding on to some traditions like hand-drawn animation and stop-motion animation that are giving those films a much fresher, much more engaging quality than some of the state-of-the-art effects films or animation.
Was there any talk about Warcraft? Because it was announced just before Comic-Con started that Sam Raimi, who of course directed Drag Me to Hell most recently, but is probably best known for his Spider-Man trilogy, he's going to be directing a film based on Warcraft, a live-action, it's a fantasy video game franchise that a lot of people now play online. Did anybody mention that? Was there any talk about that?
I thought Sam Raimi was supposed to have had a panel there, but I didn't see anything about that. But I didn't cover much gaming. I was mostly doing films and comics.
Now that's interesting that you say that, Beth, because Comic-Con also has television, which I know, Patrick, you may be...
Yeah, we covered quite a bit.
So I know that they have film, comic books, and television. I don't know whether they have music. I know they have a film festival, as we discussed earlier. Beth was one of the judges. Patrick, did you attend any of the television panels?
I didn't actually attend the panels. I was in the press room most of the time, but we did have people attending the panels and covering a lot of it. And from the coverage that we reported, the Lost panel sounds like it was a pretty hilarious experience. The producers there tend to like putting on a show for the fans without actually revealing anything about what's coming up with the show.
Well, they did reveal that some of the people from the first, some of the cast members, that is, from the first season are going to be on this next season in 2010, which of course is the final season. I actually just watched the final episode of last season, finally, and of course that's where the big nuclear bomb goes off, and I thought, you know, how brilliant. Now they can bring everybody back. They can kind of like reboot the television show.
Yes. They have been hinting for a while now that they may or may not bring back some of the original cast members who have perished on the island. One of the funny things that they did at the panel was show kind of an Oscar-style in-memoriam reel where they showed all the characters in the show who have been killed off, and it was a pretty long list, so... it remains to be seen. I did glimpse Ian Somerhalder at Comic-Con, so I don't know what he was there for, but...
Well, I know for television they also had panels for True Blood, and there was one for Flash Forward, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep.
And there was also another one for Fringe.
Dexter and Fringe.
Mm-hmm. They did V, they did Stargate Universe, they did Flash, you already said Flash Forward.
Yeah. And I think Patrick Goldstein, the LA Times, pointed out that they even had like a Patricia Heaton TV show that had no relation to science fiction at Comic-Con. But in the notes from the publicist, they said, well, she is like a superheroic mom.
Yes, so, that was kind of funny, actually.
Like anybody who's looking to promote their product showed up at Comic-Con. And on that note, unfortunately, after 1 hour of conversation, unfortunately, I've got to run.
Well, before you run,
I'm sorry, Sperling.
Before you run, I just want to congratulate you. You pegged G-Force as the winner of the box office this weekend, and... If we were just mentioning 3D and whether it's a gimmick or not, G-Force won the weekend in box office.
Yeah, God help us, huh?
$32.1 million.
No, it's surprising to see a bunch of guinea pigs take down Harry Potter. But I do think that 3D Family Fair is the wave of the future. And let's hope like Christmas Carol is a lot better than it looked at Comic-Con, because I agree with you guys. It looked pretty boring, frankly.
Pointless, I think, is the word.
Yeah.
Yeah, lethargic.
Well, Patrick and Beth, before you jump off, any thoughts on this week's box office? I mean, I thought Harry Potter was going to keep winning the weekend for at least another week or two, and it dropped off 61%.
I mean, I think with something like Harry Potter, I think you have so many of the hardcore fan base going out in full force that opening weekend that it's not surprising to see it drop off, I don't think, for something like that.
Yeah, I would agree. I think there was so much pent-up demand for this movie because it was bumped from last November to make room for Twilight that the fans haven't had a Harry Potter movie for almost 2 years, I think. So I think it's not surprising that there was such a large drop. I think it still made something like $30 million in its second weekend, which I think is pretty respectable.
Yes, and to date, in North America, it's made $221.8 million. G-Force made $32.1 million in its first weekend. The Ugly Truth also opened this weekend, and that stars Katherine Heigl and, why am I forgetting his name?
Gerard Butler.
Gerard Butler. They opened in The Ugly Truth, which made $27 million to come in third place. Orphan, the horror film from Warner Brothers, also opened this week and finished a distant fourth at $12.7 million.
That surprises me.
It kind of surprises me, too, a little bit, although I haven't actually seen the film, but I heard it was terrible.
Well, I think people are suffering from a bit of a burnout on horror films because there have been so many that really aren't that interesting. I mean, they're following a formula. They're either playing to the gore factor and playing that up, or they're playing to the PG-13, trying to appeal to like a younger female crowd and playing up atmosphere as opposed to gore. But a lot of these films just feel so formulaic that I think people are getting burnt out on them.
I think you may be right there. Even a film as wonderful as we were talking earlier about Drag Me to Hell, which is a very good horror film, didn't do as well as people had hoped it would. So,
well, I think that suffered from people having certain expectations about Sam Raimi. I mean, I know a lot of people who know Sam Raimi only from Spider-Man.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And didn't expect the humor that was in Drag Me to Hell.
Well, in fifth place this week at the box office, Ice Age Dawn of the Dinosaurs, a film everybody expected to do well, and yet another 3D film. So there's two 3D films in the top 10, or at least in the top five. It made $8.2 million. To date, in North America, it's made $171.2 million. Rounding out the top six, I don't know why I went to six instead of just five this week, Transformers Revenge of the Fallen at $8 million, falling another 41%. It's made $379.1 million in North America so far, so I'm sure they don't care how much it falls.
Well, you know, actually, you just mentioned about the 3D. Harry Potter was supposed to open in IMAX, but because of all the confusion with the date, I don't think it's opening in IMAX for another week. So the drop-off may actually have something to do with people waiting for it to reopen. I think fans who went to see it because they wanted to be there opening night are thinking about going to see it a second time once it reopens in the IMAX theaters.
That will actually be interesting to watch because, of course, Harry Potter was rescheduled and IMAX had already promised those venues, the IMAX venues, to Transformers for 4 weeks.
Right.
So next week will be the end of that 4 weeks and Harry Potter will open for 4 weeks on IMAX. And it will be interesting to see if they get a bump on that.
Yeah.
And the Guinea Pig movie cut off the legs of Ice Age because there aren't enough 3D theaters to go around. Ice Age sort of dropped a little bit further than it should have.
Yeah, that's true.
So you're saying guinea pigs can beat out dinosaurs.
I have one more Comic-Con question. It has to do with comic books, since that's the first word in Comic-Con. I wonder what was the most interesting or fun or exciting thing you read or saw or heard about as far as comic books and graphic novels. The biggest news I saw, I guess, is Jeff Smith turning out more spinoffs of Bone. But I wonder what you guys saw and got excited about.
Well, I saw an interesting one thing was interesting. They had a number of 40th anniversary panels talking to people. They were focusing on a different decade each panel of going back and talking to different people from Comic-Con who've seen changes going on there. I saw an interesting panel on Mad Magazine on Harvey Kurtzman, which had a lot of people talking about what made him great, and that was a good panel. Oh, the quick draw panel was always fun, which is where they have a number of cartoonists who do quick draw improv to things that the audience throws out at them. And that's always a really delightful. Sergio Aragonés is like an amazingly fast cartoonist, and that's a blast to watch.
Patrick, what about yourself?
I have to admit, I was so busy paying attention to films and TV, I didn't actually follow anything having to do with comic books, which is sad for something called Comic-Con.
That's right. What does Comic-Con stand for? Isn't it comic convention or conference?
I think that's what it means, yeah.
I mean, their mission statement has to do with celebrating the popular arts, and the focus had always been comic books, but, I mean, if you look at their mission statement, it's about the popular arts in general.
On that note, I'd like to thank all of our panelists, including the few who had to leave. I know that Todd Gilchrist had to run to a screening of District 9. He, of course, his writing can be found at Cinematical and Sci-Fi Wire, among many other outlets. I'd like to thank Patrick Lee, who is, of course, the news editor of Sci-Fi Wire, and Harry Medved, who had to take off a little early as well. He is the spokesperson for Fandango, and we'll put a link to Fandango's Comic-Con coverage in the show notes. Philip Knockoff, who left us a little earlier to jump on another phone call, he is the Vice President of Marketing and Publicity for Movieset.com. We'll place links to all of these people's Twitter accounts and websites in the show notes. Finally, Beth Accomando, thank you very much for joining us. Her coverage of Comic-Con can be found at NPR and the Cinema Junkie blog on kpbs.org. It was very nice of all of those panelists to join us. I don't think we've ever had that many panelists.
That was fascinating.
Absolutely. I just kept my mouth shut. There were so many in the room. I just wanted to hear what they would have to say.
Yeah, same here.
You know, I think, quite honestly, and this is a little bit of a behind the scenes at Showbiz Sandbox, I don't know whether we should have that many panelists. Not that each one of them wasn't brilliant, but it was really hard.
I think two guests at the same time is the most you should do.
Yes, I'm beginning to agree with that. But really what wound up happening was I didn't know whether any of them were going to make it because they were all at Comic-Con when I was chatting with them via email and Facebook and Twitter. So I had no clue that all, I don't know how many, five panelists would come back and say, yeah, we can do it.
Well, Sperling, when you throw a dinner party, you know, if you invite 10 guests, you better be prepared for all, you better have enough meat to go around.
Or in this case, enough, you know, mic inputs. Now, Michael, I know you highlighted a story for us that you wanted to talk about this week that was about Michael Jackson.
That's right. People are bidding for the film and TV rights to rehearsal footage of Michael Jackson's last concert. Television was involved at one point. NBC was trying to buy an hour-long special that could lead into the first episode of Jay Leno's primetime talk show debut, but that seems to have fallen by the wayside. And now it looks like it's down to worldwide rights for a movie, and the bidding has gone up to $75 million, reportedly, according to showbiz411.com and a couple other websites. I'm just wondering what you guys think about that as a business decision. It could be a fascinating movie. I'd love to see the footage. It's interesting. But $75 million for a concert film, to me, is insane because the top-grossing concert film of all time has only made $60 million in the U.S., and that's Hannah Montana. The second highest-grossing has made $19 million. Concert films don't make money. And so for this movie to make any sense at all, it has to be the top-grossing concert film of all time by a factor of, you know, 10. So it just seems a bad business decision.
But Michael, let's review. Michael Jackson as a performer in concert and Michael Jackson on record on an album are all record setters.
There have been, the Rolling Stones have had concert films, Bruce Springsteen, The Who, Led Zeppelin, all of them at the peak of their powers.
He's like an international superstar.
Led Zeppelin, Bruce Springsteen, U2, these are huge international superstars. ABBA have had concert films. These are all the biggest acts in the world.
People don't cry
over them. They're as big-selling acts concert-wise and CD-wise as Michael Jackson was. You know, Michael Jackson has not been a concert force in the U.S. I mean, his last tour was 20 years ago.
2001 was his last show.
It's rehearsal footage. It's a guy walking through a song. But, I mean, however good it may be, however big a star he is, If it's going to have to make twice as much as the biggest concert film of all time just to break even, to me it doesn't seem like a good business decision.
You know what I would do with it? I would make a documentary. I wouldn't make a concert film.
They are. They're going to have – it's a concert film with – most concert films have documentary footage, Woodstock, U2, Rattle and Hum. But this is – and they were the biggest act in the world. U2, Rattle and Hum came on the tail end of
1988.
Joshua Tree.
Yeah, that's right.
Right. But this will be behind-the-scenes footage, him talking, walking, looking at dancers and choreographers, and walking through songs, performing some songs, partially stopping, doing full songs. See, it's not, they don't have a concert film to show. It's literally rehearsal footage of everything, backstage, talking, chatting, dancing,
I think people
practicing.
Would love to see that.
I think so, too.
But you think it's going to make $150 million?
Not $150. It might.
Well,
who knows?
But if you pay $75 million.
Yeah, I think it could.
You think it'll make three times as much as the biggest grossing concert film of all time? And really, that movie is an outlier. The second biggest is $19 million. Most concert films never make $20 million. Yeah, I mean, keep it in context. $20 million is the second highest grossing concert film of all time. It doesn't, to me, it's like you're expecting the movie to be Titanic in order to break even. And again, if you pay $75 million, it has to gross $150 million, plus that's just to break even, and then you got to launch it. So it has to make $250 million, $300 million worldwide just to break even, and every concert film in history has made no more than $20 million, except for one.
So what you're saying
is Michael Jackson.
He hasn't sold an album. He hasn't sold any new albums in, 10, 15 years. He sold a couple million albums in the last few weeks. Elvis
yeah, but he
concert.
Stalled Twitter.
Elvis.
Stalled the internet.
The Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Led Zeppelin, U2. Michael Jackson is not like the only pop star in the world by a factor of 10.
You know, I was just reading this, I guess Michael Lang, the person, the promoter who put Woodstock together, wrote a book.
Awesome.
And in the book, they talk about how he sold his rights for, I think, $31,000 at the end of it. He just sold his rights to it. And they sold it to Warner Brothers over the next 10 years with all the records and movies. Those rights were worth $50 million. Warner Brothers made $50 million off of that.
Most of that was CD sales.
Probably, yes.
Yeah.
Well, I know.
Yeah, the movie hasn't grossed $10 million. It's like $8 million at the box office.
But is that $8 million in 1969, 1970 money? Because the film came out in 1970.
Double it if you like. They had $16 million.
Okay. Well, I know we spent a lot
The Beatles, but the Beatles were the biggest act in the world. A Hard Day's Night, an incredibly entertaining film.
Yeah,
put it in today's
world,
dollars.
It's connected differently now than it was back then.
All bets are off, Michael.
Well, I want to see the movie, but financially, I want someone else to pay the money so I can see it. If I'm a studio
so
exec, I'm going to take
I should put my $75 million elsewhere?
Oh, God, please. Yeah.
You know what? I'm just going to wait for the DVD.
Exactly.
I'm going to Netflix it.
Well, I know we spent a lot of time on Comic-Con today. It's a huge event. I don't know if you were on the internet over the weekend. You'd have to be blind not to know that it was happening in San Diego. Of course, we always end our show with a little bit of inside baseball, as we like to call it, a little peek at some of the inside workings of the entertainment industry. And this week, of course, has given us a huge bonanza, I don't know what you'd call it, but something that we have talked about.
Gift, Sperling, it's a gift.
Gift, yes, a gift. Thank you. But you know what? We've been talking about it for weeks. The press has been talking about it for weeks. Ben Silverman, the co-chairman of NBC Entertainment and Universal Media Studios, has resigned, and he will be moving to IAC, which is Barry Diller's company.
Yeah, to do something that is really sort of vague about, like, truly innovative, truly integrated content to truly integrate television and new media.
Well, it says here in the press release, Ben Silverman, who has been co-chairman NBC Entertainment and Universal Media Studios, has announced that he is returning to his entrepreneurial roots to form a new venture. He will remain in his current role for several weeks to assist in the launch of NBC's fall schedule. Mark Graboff, who has also been co-chairman, will continue as chairman, NBC Entertainment and Universal Media Studios, reporting to Gaspin. And Gaspin is Jeff Gaspin, who will now be the chairman of NBC Universal Television Entertainment.
Well, I think what Karen was referring to is Barry Diller Company's press release, which said that Silverman will unite producers, creators, advertisers, and distributors under one roof, which makes it sound like a big brother for Hollywood.
Well, I mean, haven't people been trying to do that for years?
Yeah.
Yes, that's why it's so wonderfully vague. It doesn't mean anything. He, like cobbled together a job before he got fired.
Yeah, well, that's what Nikki Fink on Deadline Hollywood was mentioning, that she knew back on, June 21st that this was going to happen because he was going to spend 3 to 4 weeks trying to put a job together so that it looks like he jumped rather than was pushed.
And he did it quite successfully. But I will say this, Barry Diller is very smart. He's been making a lot of money in Hollywood for decades with different ventures. And people laughed when he bought Home Shopping Network or the other one, I forget which. And he's built an internet, online powerhouse. And he doesn't waste money and he doesn't throw money around. So if Barry Diller is going to give him a job, he might actually, make something of it. Barry Diller will give him a chance.
Well, they're forming a new company. Together. So it's IAC and Ben Silverman. They're forming this new, business, this new organization.
Well, and as much as I love to mock Ben Silverman, Reveille did pretty well, his old production company. So he's clearly not an idiot, but he just didn't belong at NBC.
Yeah, they produced The Office.
Yeah, they produced a lot of, they had a lot of successful things. Of course, for every, The Office, he had, Knight Rider when he was at NBC and My Own Worst Enemy and all those horrible bombs. He just didn't have any business running a network. Yeah. But he's as a producer, he knows what he's doing.
Nikki Fink said she was asleep at 6 o'clock in the morning when her phone started ringing, and she writes, and I quote, "Silverman was finally letting boss Jeff Zucker off the hook for a hiring decision that will go down in the annals of television entertainment as one of the worst."
True.
Do either of you have any impression of Gaspin and whether he has good taste and has done good commercial stuff?
I have no idea, but I would have thought it would have been Graboff who would have gotten that job.
Yeah, he got sort of screwed from what I understand. I think that's part of the story is that people don't really know that much about either one of them in terms of taste and personality, that they're sort of suits. But when you compare to the debacle that was Ben Silverman, a nice boring suit, it's probably exactly what NBC needs right now.
Well, yeah.
Well, what I loved was the Hollywood Reporter story about this event, which was written by George Zalay and Nellie Andreeva. I apologize for mispronouncing their names. But at the bottom, they gave a lot of credit to Ryan Seacrest for Twittering about it and sort of news story. Yeah. And Ryan Seacrest is talking, this is great news for Hollywood. He says it means better shows from our favorite stars in U.S. and around the world. Ben Silverman, just filling me in. And as Hollywood Reporter said, sounds like Ryan Seacrest is going to be doing some work with Ben Silverman and Barry Diller down the road.
Totally. I'm sure that's exactly what's going to happen.
I think those two are friends, aren't they? Ben Silverman and Ryan Seacrest?
You know better than I do.
I don't.
Yeah, it's been alluded that there's been more than that, but that's strictly gossip.
Evans, I don't think Ryan Seacrest would joke about being gay on national television if he wasn't back closeted. And Simon Cowell always says that he is straight. He says that Ryan Seacrest is straight. you never know. Anything is possible, I suppose.
To answer your question, they definitely are friends.
Only time will tell how this plays out and whether it's good for NBC or bad for NBC. But certainly, Ben Silverman was a distraction there at NBC.
And not a very well-liked one, from what I understand.
Well, on that note, I think we've pretty much reached the end of our show. It's probably going to run a little long. For links to all of the stories we discussed on this episode, visit our website at showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll also find links to all of our social network accounts, including Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. If you want to email us, the address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can leave us a voicemail at 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. If you want to send us news stories, you can do so through the social bookmarking website Delicious. Just tag any link, showbizsandbox, all one word, and we will find it. So Karen, Michael, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Of course, Michael, your work can always be found at michaelgiltz.com.
Yep.
And Michael Giltz, still not on Twitter.
No.
Get on Twitter!
I could Twitter, I'm going to be on Showbiz Sandbox in a few minutes.
Yeah!
We'd appreciate that.
Every week!
Exactly. Until next week, guys, play nice.